Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Sean McMeekin, whose wondrous and extremely rich new book, Stalin's War, tells the story of what we remember as the Second World War from the point of view of the Kremlin manipulating all sides, many different sides, through all of the machinations of September 1939 till the crisis that becomes the Cold War in 1948. We're now in September 1940 when the Tripartite Pact is signed in Berlin, including the Japanese, the Italians, and the Germans, not Russia. What's critical here is how Russia regarded this non-inclusion, given that Stalin had some kind of relationship with Berlin at this moment. We go now to November 12, 1940. Molotov, the gangster, who is now the representative of Stalin to foreign governments, travels under what you'd have to say operatic circumstances from Moscow to Berlin. He's received with people singing the Internationale, and Sean assures us they played it double time so that nobody in the area would be tempted to sing. There were still lots of communists in Berlin in November of 1940. Ribbentrop, Hitler, Himmler, and Keitel, head of the army, greet Molotov. What they're concerned about is the possibility that Moscow will enter into the Tripartite Pact, which is for peace. Sean, everything about this is operatic. I want to go to what Hitler said to Molotov, or might have said to Molotov when he greets him at the foreign ministry. What did Hitler want from Molotov about the Tripartite Pact?
Well, the Tripartite Pact was in part a kind of cosmetic updating of the old anti-Comintern Pact, which had, after all, been directed against the Soviet Union. Effectively, it was now against the Anglo-Saxons, as both the Germans and at times the Soviets called them, that is, Britain and the United States. So what Hitler is hoping is that he can get Molotov and Stalin to agree to this, that effectively the Anglo-Saxon imperialist domination of the world is unfair, and he's hoping that the Soviets will go along with this. The problem is that the Soviets really have a kind of economic stranglehold over Germany, partly because of their positioning in Finland, partly because of their positioning in the Balkans. Hitler relies on the Balkan supply route for things such as chrome, which they need in producing nearly all of their war material, and particularly petroleum oil. Hitler gets about half of his oil from Romania. He gets about a third from the Soviet Union. So the Soviets have this kind of dominating hold, really, over Germany's ability to wage war. And Hitler is hoping that he can get Stalin to agree on spheres of influence. And in fact, from the German perspective, both Ribbentrop and Hitler, to the extent we know how they reacted, although they were a bit frustrated at how stubborn Molotov was in laying down Stalin's own demands, they thought they had more or less mollified Molotov. However, Stalin was a much tougher negotiator. What Stalin wanted from the Germans was their promise to basically withdraw all of their troops from Finland, all of their troops from Romania, and to give the Soviet Union permission to invade Bulgaria and Turkey, basically to station troops at the Bosporus, ostensibly to keep the British out of the Black Sea. And these were things that Hitler simply was not willing to give. Germany was far too vulnerable economically to let Stalin have any more of really the Balkan area. And so effectively, talks broke down then. And it's really in the course of Hitler responding to this almost in shock at Stalin's brazen demands. He actually kind of throws almost a temper tantrum meeting the Bulgarian minister to Berlin in early December 1940. And this is when Hitler moves ahead with what we now call Operation Barbarossa, the plan to invade the Soviet Union.
Is there an element here where Berlin wanted Russia and Japan to come to a peace negotiation? They've been at war for several years now, and the Japanese have been intimidated by the success of the Russians. Does Berlin want to settle that, or is Berlin indifferent?
Well, Berlin at the time, strangely enough, was trying to push for a rapprochement between Japan and the Soviet Union. Of course, if you fast forward a year later, this is nonsense. Germany is going to invade the Soviet Union, and Germany would have been much better off had Japan, of course, participated in the war against the Soviet Union. However, in 1940, at the time we're talking about, the Germans still had hopes of keeping the Soviets on board, and they thought that Japan could be useful in that sense. If they could negotiate terms between Japan and the Soviet Union, perhaps Japan could make some concessions on Sakhalin Island or with some of the fisheries disputes and other territorial issues in Asia, then maybe they could keep the Soviets satisfied. And that could have freed up resources and perhaps intimidated, really. I think Hitler was at the time just trying to intimidate Britain and behind her, as he saw the United States, into coming to terms. In the end, it was kind of this disjointed thinking on the part of the Germans and Hitler. It really made no sense, whereby the following spring, on the one hand, they're still encouraging Soviet Japanese rapprochement while planning to invade the Soviet Union, which, of course, makes no sense strategically. In the end, Hitler just was kind of outthought, you might say, strategically by Stalin and Molotov.
You mentioned Finland. After Poland, there was the Finnish War launched by Stalin. The Russians did very poorly. But what's important here is that the Finnish War triggered the enmity from London, Paris, and Washington that did not follow naturally from the invasion of Poland. At this point, Stalin has made peace with Finland, I believe, or he's reaching for an accommodation with Finland. But the driver here is the U.S. What is the U.S.'s opinion? What is Roosevelt's opinion of Stalin now as they negotiate November of 1940?
Well, Roosevelt's position had changed at least temporarily during the Soviet-Finnish War. Previously, he had been, generally speaking, rather friendly to the Soviet Union. He'd even sacked an ambassador, William Buitt, who had been a little bit too critical of Stalin's regime, and sent this famous kind of apologist, Joseph Davies, who helped to whitewash the Great Terror. The Finnish War had jolted Roosevelt somewhat, and he had actually denounced it as aggression and had even declared what he called a moral embargo on U.S. strategic imports to the Soviet Union at the time. And at the time, we shouldn't forget the war in Poland is effectively over. If you had Drôle de Guerre or the phony war, as we call it in English, or the Sitzkrieg, as the Germans call it in the West, where not much was happening. And so at the time, Roosevelt was focused on Finland and had, at least for that brief period, had kind of become somewhat hostile to the Soviets. And he's still in that position in late 1940. However, in early 1941, things begin to shift. It's not entirely clear what changes Roosevelt's thinking, but beginning in January and February of 1941, he quietly begins to lift that moral embargo on the Soviet Union. It's partly just because of the general chatter, which begins to overwhelm Europe about the inevitable, as a lot of people see it, clash between the Germans and the Soviets, where I think Roosevelt ends up seeing the Soviets a bit like Churchill does as a possible bulwark against the Germans, even though ostensibly they're still collaborating. A lot of people are beginning to expect that they're going to break. This, at least, is a subject of general chatter. And I think that does begin to shift the thinking of Roosevelt and some of his advisors early in 1941.
Molotov's conversations with Hitler on the first day were happy. On the follow-up conversation, not so happy. So Hitler did not attend the farewell dinner. There are scenes here that suggest tragedy, but also there's farce. At the farewell dinner, they're toasting each other, drinking a lot of everything. However, the British arrive overhead, the nighttime bombing of Berlin. Hitler has promised, Himmler's promised, Ribbentrop has promised, the war is 99% over. And they run to the downstairs to the air raid shelter. It's a wonderful scene. At this point, Molotov is taking back to Moscow his opinion. Does he believe that Moscow wants to participate with the Germans, or are they already turning their face towards invasion?
No, I think Molotov has already decided that the Germans are not going to agree to Stalin's terms, that Hitler had shown kind of more teeth than he was expecting on issues regarding Bulgaria and Finland in particular. It's not that Molotov knows what the Germans will do and when, but there's clearly a break. In fact, Molotov senses it even before Ribbentrop and Hitler did. Although, of course, the Germans were much more forthright and rapid in their own military planning. The Soviets are absolutely now planning for a war with Germany beginning in November, December 1940. You can see this in all of their kind of their new deployment scenarios, how they're allocating resources, where they're deploying and building their new air bases. They're clearly preparing for a war with Germany after December 1940, even if they don't know how and when it's going to start.
The book is Stalin's War. Sean McMeekin, the author at Bard College. And the war is around us, but the big jump off is ahead of us in 1941. And that will require both the United States and Britain to reorganize their opinion of Stalin, the invader and persecutor and monster towards the Polish people, towards the Finnish people, towards the people of the Baltic states. It's burned in stone what Stalin did. 1939, 1940, and 41. But Stalin's about to become a victim. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your Social Security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.